Chapter 37. Satisfied, but not finished. The song of Christian Science is, quote, work, work, work. Watch and pray, end quote. Mary Baker Eddy. 1900. The general thought at the end of 1899 was that a new century was dawning. On the 7th of January, the leader wrote to Augusta Stetson in New York City, "My beloved student, your costly wearing apparel, your fruit and flowers sent to me at the close of the 19th century, are blessed precursors of your fidelity in the field and pledges of your unextinguished love for me. Accept, dear one, thanks from the depths of a lone, loving heart, whom the world hath not yet half known, but which you value and seek to comfort. Please write to me relative to the meeting of some of the members of the Mother Church in your city. Strange indeed that at this momentous hour they should have met thus without informing me. I see it can be made a means of informing others. With love and my prayers for your safety, prosperity, and happiness, this and every year of your pilgrimage. Give mother's love and best wishes of the season to your dear church. Ever lovingly thine, Mary Baker Eddy." Possibly this momentous hour marked the close of the woman's 19th century mission to waken the earthbound. Very likely, she felt that her great life work was completed when she wrote, "Satisfied." But neither her work nor the century was ended. Some newspapers proclaimed the beginning of the new century in January 1900, but others pointed out that the 19th century would not end until December 31st, 1900. The 20th century would dawn with 1901. Hundreds of letters passed between Mrs. Eddy and her devoted disciple in New York over the years. In the spring of 1900, Augusta was telling the leader with grateful enthusiasm of her newest student, a young man of great promise named William D. McCracken. But the circumstance mentioned in the leader's letter of January 7th may have prompted the following new rule, which appeared in the Sentinel not long thereafter. A member of the Mother Church, who is not the clerk thereof, shall not appoint a meeting of the first members of this church. Only the clerk appoints said meetings, and in accordance with the bylaws of this church. The incessant, insidious work of the enemy had to be met worldwide this last year of the century, and the leader saw that to meet it effectively required an enlargement of her publishing committee. Early in January, she asked Mr. Tomlinson to write the bylaw which she had seen as necessary. Her answer to his letter later in the month said, "Yours just read. Before I received it, I had typed my bylaw relating to publishing committee. I thank you for your dear interest in our cause. I thank God that I can call on you for help. But, dear one, never attempt to steady the altar. God had told me what to do before the subject was named to you, and you will be delighted to hear that I had requested the clerk to read my letter requesting the church to elect Mr. Farlow." Quote, "Never attempt to steady the altar," end quote. This was a mild rebuke to Mr. Tomlinson. But the letter she had written to the clerk on January 8th was much more severe. Beloved student, I only asked Mr. Tomlinson to write that bylaw for me, but he sent it to the church before I had examined it. Herein, find the proper bylaw as written by myself. Wipe out the other one. Do not vote on a bylaw except when I have sent it. With love, M. B. Eddy. Note well. Do not change the name of the street unless some great advantage is to be derived from it. Say in open meeting to my church that Mother recommends that this church elect Mr. Alfred Farlow, CSD, to constitute the publishing committee. Again, M. B. Eddy. In this 20th century, few other than Christian Scientists are aware that one person can constitute a committee. Even few Christian Scientists are aware of what the enemy has done to the words and dictionaries of our English language. The word committee is a point in question. Noah Webster, the father of American English, in his 1828 unabridged lexicon, began his definition of committee, quote, one or more persons elected or appointed to whom any matter or business is referred, end quote. By 1936, a Webster's Collegiate Dictionary had divided the definition of committee into parts, but the first part still read, quote, number one, a person to whom some trust or charge is committed, end quote. America stands for the integrity and freedom of the individual. But the age of the Church of the Laodiceans would subjugate the individual to the group. By the middle of the 20th century, the first definition for committee in a Webster's College Edition dictionary read, quote, number one, a group of people chosen to consider some matter or to function in a certain capacity, end quote. This word represents but one of the many, many changes. The spiritual import has been largely deleted from the dictionaries of today, though many still retain or use Webster's name. Fortunate indeed is the student who can study his textbooks with the aid of Noah Webster's original masterpiece, An American Dictionary of the English Language. The new bylaw relating to the publishing committee appeared in the January 18, 1900 edition of the Sentinel. The large branch churches in the principal cities of the United States and Canada are hereby requested to appoint a publishing committee to serve in their localities under their church bylaws. Another area of concern for the leader early in 1900 was the teaching. Her article titled Church Bylaws in the January 18th Sentinel began with these two paragraphs. The bylaw on page 66, Article 30, Section 7, in our church manual, shall be amended so as to read, not less than four lessons, and more if requisite, and but one each day, shall be given to students in obstetrics, under the auspices of the Massachusetts Metaphysical College. A student in this class shall prepare a paper on accouchement, giving in detail the physical and mental treatment requisite for the scientific and safe delivery of the mother. This paper shall be discussed by the class and examined by the teacher, who shall decide as to the proper qualification of his pupils to practice obstetrics. The tuition of students in obstetrics is $100 each for one course, and they shall pay their tuition to the teacher in this department. Not less than 3 thorough lessons by a well-qualified teacher shall be given to each primary and normal class on the subject of mental practice and malpractice. The students in this class shall be required to prepare a paper on this subject, and after reading it and having it thoroughly discussed by the class and understood, they shall retain no copy of it, but shall give the paper immediately to their teacher, who shall decide upon its thoroughness and accuracy. This paper shall be sent to Mrs. Eddy, President of the Massachusetts Metaphysical College, for examination, if she so requires, before the normal class students shall receive their certificates of degrees. The session shall continue not less than 2 weeks. In January, the Sentinel published Mrs. Eddy's message to the first annual meeting of the Concord Church, Miscellany, page 154, wherein she said that, quote, the church militant embodied in a visible communion, end quote, foreshadows, quote, the church triumphant, end quote. January Sentinels also published the order of services in the Mother Church, followed by the statement that insofar as local conditions would permit, it would be well for the branch churches to follow the same order for the purpose of having a uniform service. An interesting advertisement first appeared in the Sentinel of January 18th. The birthplace of Mary Baker Eddy, reproduced by the aid of Mrs. Eddy's information. Photographs of site and authentic data. This is the title of a well-executed etching from an original drawing by Rufus H. Baker. It restores on paper the Baker homestead as it appeared in Mrs. Eddy's girlhood. Now the site is but a tithe of the old farm, and only a few fruit trees remain to suggest the once fine orchards. This picture has been made possible mainly through Mrs. Eddy's kindly assistance. These paragraphs, followed by description, prices, and Rufus Baker's address, continued to appear in subsequent issues. The leader gave assistance to ever so many people in various commercial enterprises. Later in the year, she asked Christian Scientists to subscribe to the Granite Monthly of Concord, New Hampshire, ever encouraging scientists to support worthwhile endeavors and deserving people. The Granite Monthly had published fair articles about the leader and her movement. Her own expressions of charity were numerous and constant. On February 5th, when Governor Rawlins of New Hampshire began a fund by subscribing $20, worth approximately 1 ounce of gold in 1900, to assist the Shakers, who had suffered a great loss by fire, Mrs. Eddy was the very first to respond to his appeal. She sent $100 for the Shakers' relief, and before the month was over, she sent $1,000 to the church in Hanover, Germany. Her greatest gifts to humanity were, however, never her money, but her words of wisdom, which she poured out daily to her students. A letter written February 2nd to help and bless Irving Tomlinson has been recorded, Miscellany, page 247, and continues to bless and guide students today with such statements as, quote, "Do you come to your little flock so filled with divine food that you cast your bread upon the waters?" End quote. The leader's words of approval and commendation were not reserved to Christian Scientists. The March Journal included the following from her pen. Dewey's Perfect Fountain Pen. The Dewey's Perfect Fountain Pen has recently entered my employ, and after 1 month's trial, I find it well named Perfect. I had tried various styles of fountain pens, but not until I got Dewey's Perfect Fountain Pen did I find one that meets the demand in every respect. To write with this pen is indeed a pleasure. It never fails to make its mark, and the construction is such there is no joint through which the ink can leak and stain the fingers. Manufactured by A.A. Waterman and Company, Boston, Mass. Mary Baker Eddy. Pleasant View, Concord, New Hampshire. February 2nd, 1900. But there were times when she had to deny those endeavoring to capitalize on her popularity without a proper motive, as is evident in this paragraph, published in the Sentinel on May 3rd. Take notice. My attention has just been called to a proof of a photograph of mine sent out by William H. Pierce and Company, Boston, which they claim is the best extant of me today. This photo is merely a facsimile of a photograph taken by an artist in Concord about 10 years ago, which I condemned, and I have refused to sit for a photograph since that date. In a letter dated April 26th, she wrote, "My thoughts form my face and its expressions. Hence, these vary, and no photographer has caught the expression of my best thoughts, or the thought of my best expression. Of this I am sure, that my works, not my face, must declare me." Nonetheless, there was great demand for pictures of the leader, and she did endeavor to meet this demand and to aid honest enterprise. In the next issue of the Sentinel, the notice about the condemned photograph was followed by her approval of her portrait, which was sold by J.C. Derby and Company, plus the announcement that she had consented to Mr. Derby's manufacturing a Christian Science insignia. Later in the spring, another announcement appeared under the title Unauthorized. We have just received a cut of a bust of the Reverend Mary Baker G. Eddy, with the accompanying information that it is manufactured and sold only by Frank C. Travers of Kirkville, Missouri. On the opposite side of the leaf, it is said by Mr. Travers that he takes, quote, "great satisfaction in presenting to the friends of Mrs. Eddy this descriptive booklet of her bust. No labor or expense has been spared in the production of this work, the original of which is the masterpiece of one of the most eminent sculptors of this country. Hence, we are able to offer a bust of the highest excellence and superior finish not equaled by any other manufacturer in the United States. End quote. In reference to this bust, we have to say it is wholly unauthorized by Mrs. Eddy or by anyone having authority to speak for her. We are informed that she had no knowledge that such a thing was contemplated. Though the criticism of the bust was from the editor's pen and not from Mrs. Eddy, the leader did have to refute another endeavor to capitalize on her name and following in the spring of 1900. Had the donors of the stock, which she returned on April 24th, been truly expressing their gratitude for Christian Science, it is probable that this gratitude would have found expression in some other form. But a selfish motive would necessitate the card the leader published in both Sentinel and Journal. A card. To the donors of the certificate of 1,000 shares in stock of Acme Smelting and Refining Company, Phoenix, Arizona, accompanied by a kind letter, I beg to say, accept this public as well as my private acknowledgement of your liberal gift, the certificate whereof I returned with my thanks on April 24th, 1900. On June 20th, 1900, I received two certificates from Ada M. Serba, who represented 306 and the other 732 shares in stock of the Argus Mining and Milling Company of Bingham Canyon, Utah. These I have also returned in like manner to the dear donor with my grateful thanks for her gift and excellent letter which accompanied it. I publish these facts to inform said givers of my actions relative to these certificates of mining stock, because I have not yet heard from them in reply to my letters and the certificates which I have returned. I am not at present, never have been, and never shall be, in any way, directly or indirectly connected with mining stock. I am looking for my treasures above, not beneath. Besides, I am not inclined to stockholding. Attacks on Christian Science and the founder continued to appear in the press. But now there was some refutation from the publishing committee in various states. Before the end of February, the publishing committee bylaw had been extended to include Great Britain, with this note appended. Note: it is understood that the committee referred to consists of one person, as indicated in previous bylaws. It also specified only one publishing committee in each state. In another month, it was enlarged or narrowed in this manner. The publishing committee shall consist of males only. The female incumbents shall immediately resign this office, and males shall be elected to fill the vacancy. It is by no means an office befitting a woman. All this time, false rumors continued to circulate. One that was a total lie began with the Independent of New York, was reprinted in the Hartford, Connecticut Post in February, and in the Boston Transcript in March. It stated that there was a split in the Christian Science Church, that over 10,000 Eddy followers had left, and that the faction had already formed over 20 churches. The truth was that new Christian Science branch churches were being formed at an unprecedented rate, and that the Mother Church membership was growing steadily, with well over 1,000 new applicants at each semi-annual admission day. An article in the Chicago Times-Herald titled, quote, "Great Growth of a Faith," end quote, gave a truer picture of the reception of Christian Science in 1900. Sunday, March 18th, 1900, another milepost marked the growth of the Christian Science denomination in Chicago. The event was the first service of the Christian Science Society of West Pullman. The new church is the fifth, which has been established in this city since 1890. The new church began its career with a membership of between 60 and 70, but the attendance following the general rule was much greater. The place of worship was a hall, which has been rented for the time being. But if the congregation does not prove an exception, it will not be long before it will have sufficient strength to build a temple of its own, and possibly, in turn, send forth from its doors an offshoot to establish another congregation in some other part of the city. The Society is a child of the First Church of Christ Scientist, as are also the Second, Third, and Fourth Churches. Early in February, the congregation of the First Church again became so large that the meetings held there were crowded, and from 100 to 200 people were compelled to stand during the services. It was recognized that the time had come for further development, and the people of West Pullman decided to start their own organization. The growth of the faith in Chicago presents some remarkable features. In the first place, it must be understood that Christian Science has drawn its following from the best elements of citizenship. Bankers, substantial businessmen, society people, and men and women of means have been attracted to it and have cheerfully accepted its teachings and are testifying today of the good it has done them. The character of the people who are accepting the faith is proof that it is not to be classed as a fad, but as a doctrine which thousands of deep thinking people want. The members of the First Church worship in a stone edifice at Drexel Boulevard and 40th Street, and have nourished to full bloom four new churches. From a small beginning, the congregations have grown to about the following proportions. First Church, 1,500. Second Church, 800. Third Church, 800. Fourth Church, 500. West Pullman, 70. The church membership and congregations do not comprise all the people who subscribe to the tenets of faith, for there are probably between 8 and 10,000 Christian Scientists in Chicago. The church edifices in which the Christian Scientists worship are free from debt. That of the First Church is a stone structure costing $112,000 and having a seating capacity of 1,500. The Second Church is erecting a stone edifice at Wrightwood and Pine Grove Avenues, which will cost $115,000, and seat 1,500. The building which the third church is constructing is of enameled brick, located at Washington Boulevard and Levitt Street, and will cost $115,000 and seat 1,500. The rapid growth of the denomination is illustrated by the fact that 1 year after the first church was dedicated, the second was started, and 1 month after the second opened its doors, the third came into existence. 33 years ago, there was but one Christian Scientist in the world, the Reverend Mary Baker G. Eddy. Today, the faith numbers 500,000 ardent followers. Little wonder that Mrs. Eddy labeled Chicago, quote, "the wonder of the Western Hemisphere," end quote. In addition to accurate first-hand reports, such as the foregoing, occasional just and appreciative articles appeared in the press. But scandalous lies circulate much faster, and malicious mind was manufacturing more and more lies. In addition, it was causing Christian Scientists to question and challenge other Christian Scientists, which forced the leader to formulate a bylaw to handle complaints against members. This was soon amended to make branch churches handle their own complaints, and enlarged to include the complainant as well as the accused. In other words, quote, "also the complainant shall cease to speak ill of him, or be subject to discipline and dismissal from this church," end quote. Another bylaw demanding self-improvement was published in the April 19th Sentinel. Both the husband and wife shall pay tuition for class instruction. Only one of them shall teach classes in Christian Science, and that one shall be elected by the two in one. In other words, both husband and wife. Any jargon as to which of those shall be teacher may exclude the jarring one from his or her office in church. But complaints against one loyal member after another continued to pour into Boston. One paragraph published in the Sentinel stated, "We feel it to be our duty to say in refutation of all rumors to the contrary, that Reverend George Tompkins, DDCS, has not retired from the Christian Science work, nor allied himself with any movement adverse to true Christian Science. He remains true to his colors and is actively in the work of Camden, New Jersey, as will be seen by his card in the Christian Science Journal." The directors did not apprise Mrs. Eddy of all the complaints, nor of their ensuing disciplinary action. One of her dear students, who was under discipline by the board, was John P. Filbert. John and his wife had been taught by the leader early in 1886, and John was in her February 1887 normal class. At a later date, they were invited to observe a class then in progress, and John had the added privilege of a private interview. He brought along his list of questions, but Mrs. Eddy gave him no opportunity to ask any, as she kept questioning him about the field and about his work. Suddenly, he realized that he was answering all of his own questions in order. When the last one was answered, Mrs. Eddy looked up at him, smiled, and said, quote, "You are getting to be a big boy, John," end quote. In the spring of 1900, when Mrs. Eddy learned that John Filbert was the subject of disciplinary action, she wrote him immediately. "Only yesterday I heard for the first time that you are being reprimanded by my church. My astonishment was indescribable. If you have erred, be like all true followers, ready to confess you have. It is not necessary that you repeat an error, but only signify your regret. And if you are not in the fault, say so, and all is canceled by my church, and God will do justly in his rewards and punishments." On the same day, the leader wrote to her board of directors, "Please pass the enclosed bylaw and also repeal the votes taken on discipline of J.P. Filbert, S.J. Sawyer, and Mrs. Graybill of Atchison, Kansas, and all other cases not done under my knowledge." Mr. Johnson wrote in response on the 4th of May, "The directors are glad to get the word to dismiss all complaints. We believe this will do much good, and we shall not have these skeletons haunting us. The slate will be wiped clean, and may we hope that it will be kept so." The leader's answer to the clerk finished the situation. "Do not record one word of the slander on the accused members. Bury it among the offal of lies." It is not improbable that all this offal of lies was the result of malpractice related to the Woodbury case, still preparing for trial. Mrs. Eddy's Boston attorneys and officials were much involved in preparing the defense, and to this end were taking a good deal of testimony. The foul stuff uncovered was often shocking, but there were occasional lighter moments, as indicated by the leader's response to a letter from William B. Johnson in April. "My beloved student, your letter and the good old man's testimony are just read, and such a laugh as I had is a rarity in these times. I could almost hear him talk, so characteristic was the written vernacular. Will you say to Judge Hannah and yourself, I thank you for the penning of it. Do not trouble yourself to copy testimony for me to read. I thank you, but have not time to indulge in it. With love, Mother, M. B. Eddy." Note well. Have got the clinch over the publication committee settled by the dint of wisdom. Carol had chosen to remain on board of lectureship rather than the publishing committee. Both, none can be, for the stuff she publishes would go into the newspapers always when the lecturer would be off on his lecture tour and no committee there to attend to it. With the hope of heaven sometime, M.B.E. The mother truly had not time to indulge in reading the testimony. Even her work of meeting and refuting the attacks and the lies was secondary. Her great work of founding Christian Science in this, quote, wicked world, unquote, must go on despite the hatred directed at her. And it did. In February, she had published the Order of Communion Service, and by the end of March, perhaps what was her most important work of 1900 was completed. The heart and soul of Mrs. Eddy's mission was her babe, science and health. And in this closing year of the 19th century, the author had once again revised her masterpiece. The advertisement for Science and Health in the Sentinel of April 5th stated, quote, 665 pages, revised, 1894, end quote. The following week, the words, quote, revised, 1894, end quote, were deleted from the advertisement, which was changed to read, quote, 675 pages, end quote. This was the only indication that 10 pages had been added to the new revision, or even that there was a new revision in 1900. Were the students so involved with the Woodbury case, the false charges, the rumors, the complaints, the disciplinary actions, their own work, that they had lost their perspective and their appreciation for the great things of lasting value? Many students were all but overwhelmed by the malice to be met at this hour. But the publishing committee was performing a vital function by publicly refuting in the newspapers the lies that were being sown broadcast. Thus, the calumny and slander aimed mainly at the leader were counteracted, but they were not stopped. Early in May, the editor of the Boston Herald asked Mrs. Eddy for a statement, and her brief response appeared in his paper on May 5th. To the editor of the Herald, I even hope that those who are kind enough to speak well of me may do so honestly and not too earnestly, and this seldom until mankind learn more of my meaning and can speak justly of my living. Mary Baker G. Eddy, Pleasant View, Concord, New Hampshire, May 4th, 1900. No one could know what the founder endured while never losing sight of her mission, nor of the underlying reality, the perfection of being. Little wonder that she had recently written in a letter to her board of lecturers, quote, millions may know that I am the founder of Christian Science. I only know what that means, end quote. Quote, with the hope of heaven sometime, end quote, the mother was ever expressing appreciation for every good work. In this letter to her, quote, 12 faithful witnesses, end quote, she stated, quote, beloved students, I am more than satisfied with your work. Its grandeur almost surprises me, end quote. The lecturers were meeting with phenomenal success. News reports from various locations stated that the lectures were very well attended, often crowded, and that the audiences were mainly non-Christian Scientists. Perhaps the adverse publicity was arousing interest, but many who came out of curiosity left to ponder the things of God. Before the end of May, the leaders, quote, faithful witnesses, end quote, were increased. An amendment of the Board of Lectureship bylaw unlimited their number so that they were no longer restricted to 12. The lecturers were truly doing a wonderful work, introducing Christian Science to the general public in a gentle, dignified way, breaking down the resistance and leavening the thought. Each lectured in his own assigned territory, with the exception of Judge Ewing, who had been on an extended nationwide tour, delivering his lecture, quote, "Christian Science, the Religion of Jesus Christ," end quote, from one end of our nation to the other. In January, he had lectured in Iowa, Illinois, Missouri, Ohio, and New York. February had found him in the far southwest, lecturing in San Diego, California. And the next few weeks, he covered California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, etc. This Colorado report from the Denver Evening Times indicates the Western reception to the lecturers in general, and to Judge Ewing in particular. The enthusiasm with which Judge Ewing of Chicago was greeted upon the occasion of his lecture on Christian Science at the Central Presbyterian Church Thursday evening, March 22nd, has not been excelled since the days when Mr. William Jennings Bryan visited Denver in 1896. No lecturer who ever visited Denver was greeted by so large an audience. The great auditorium of the church was wholly inadequate to accommodate those who sought admission. The sidewalk in front of the church was black with people an hour and a half before time for the lecture, and hundreds of people were turned away, unable to get within hearing distance of the lecture. Judge Ewing's tour next brought him back to the Midwest, then north to Wisconsin, the second week in April, at about the same time that Charles M. Howe was enjoying the privilege of an interview with the leader at Pleasant View. Mid-April was Easter Sunday, which was a red-letter day in Montreal, Canada. It marked the opening of the first church in the entire British Empire that was built by and for Christian Scientists. This was Clara Shannon's church, to which the leader sent the following message for their opening service. First Church of Christ Scientist, Montreal, Canada. Beloved brethren, accept my thanks for your tender Easter greeting. May the risen Christ illumine the history of your church and the lives of its dear members with eternal light and love. Mary Baker Eddy. Another Easter message from the leader was a telegram to the directors in Boston, who had sent an Easter gift of potted plants. God bless my old board of directors and their plants. With love, Mother. The leader's feelings this Easter season were set down the following Wednesday and published in the next issue of the journal. Easter Morn. Gently thou beckonest from the giant hills, and newborn beauty in the emerald sky, and wakening murmurs from the drowsy rills. O gladsome dayspring, reft of mortal sigh, to glorify all time, eternity, with thy still fathomless Christ majesty. Brightly thou gildest gladdened joy, dear God. Give risen power to prayer. Fan thou the flame of right with might. And midst the rod and stern dark shadows, cast on thy blessed name. Lift thou a patient love above earth's ire, piercing the clouds with its triumphal spire. With sacred song and loudest breath of praise, echoing amidst the hymning spheres alight, and heaven's lyres and angels' loving lays, send to the loyal struggler for the right, joy, not of time, and not by nature sown, but the celestial seed dropped from love's throne. prolong the strain. Christ risen. Sad sense, annoy no more the peace of soul's sweet solitude. Deep loneness, tear-filled tones of distant joy. Depart, glad Easter glows with gratitude. Love's verdure veils the leaflet's wondrous birth. Rich rays, rare footprints on the dust of earth. Not life the vassal of the changeful hour, nor burdened bliss, but truth and love attest the solemn splendor of immortal power, the ever-Christ and glorified behest, poured on the sense that deems no suffering vain, which wipes away the sting of death, sin, pain. Judge Ewing most likely spent the Easter holiday at his home in Chicago, but he was very soon back on the road lecturing in Iowa, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Maryland, New York, and then on up into New England. His lecture of May 26 may have been the most interesting of his entire tour. Surely the afterglow was. It was stormy that Saturday night in the Bethlehem of America, Lynn, Massachusetts, when Judge Ewing stepped onto the platform. Stormy in more ways than one, for the judge found himself facing a very hostile audience. The antagonism was so great that he felt it was useless to deliver his prepared lecture. So instead, he got down from the platform and, standing right before the people, took them into his confidence in his friendly, winning way. He praised their town. He told them how he had learned in his recent travels that it was well known all over the land for its wonderful footwear. After some expansion on this theme, he was able to tell them the real reason why Lynn would never fade from the history of the world. It was the birthplace of science and health. Then, allowing spirit to speak through him, he told in beautiful, sympathetic language of some of Mrs. Eddy's struggles, privations, and difficulties in bringing forth her book, and emphasized that it was only her deep love for mankind that enabled her to stand and overcome all that she had to meet. There was hardly a dry eye when he finished talking about Mrs. Eddy. Then the judge went back up onto the platform and delivered his lecture, Christian Science, the Religion of Jesus Christ. The next morning, Judge Ewing had an appointment with Mrs. Eddy at Pleasant View, so he boarded the earliest train to Concord. The first thing the leader did was to thank him for all the things he had said about her the night before, assuring him how true they were, and quoting almost his exact words, which had been totally extemporaneous. The judge became more and more puzzled, knowing that he had come on the first train since his lecture, which train had also brought the newspapers, and that she had not possibly had time to read any reports. Finally, he burst out, "How do you know what I said?" Mrs. Eddy's simple reply was, "Suppose I told you that I heard you." The thoughts of Christian Scientists all over the world were turning to the annual communion season of the Mother Church. Communion would be celebrated in Boston on Sunday, June 3rd, and the annual meeting of the Mother Church was to be held the following Tuesday. In the past, the periodicals had encouraged attendance, but attendance was not emphasized in 1900 because of this instructive letter from the Mother to the Board of Directors and editor Hannah. As an exception to the positive rule that our annual meeting shall not be overrun, I herein say, let them come at our annual meeting this year, as many as want to come. Leave it to their option. With attendance, neither encouraged nor discouraged, many hundreds, perhaps thousands of scientists would be coming to Boston, and preparation for all these visitors was requisite. In the leader's eyes, preparation meant that the Mother Church must set an example for the branch church members. But once again, she had to thunder to her board of directors to waken them to action. Her letter of May 16th, intended to rouse them to attend to God's work, was emphasized by underlining, to the board of directors, beloved students, once more, God thunders in your ears. Quote, get a reading room in Boston and locate it in that part of the city where people will be most apt to go into it. End quote. Again, I say, unless you do this at once and have it ready, furnished and ready, before our communion season, it will be ill with thee. I see this. I know it. You have not prospered since you disobeyed God in not getting the right location and at the time he bade you do it for another church building and publishing house for his word to be heard therefrom. I beg for God's dear sake, for your own and for mine, that you obey this call. Announce at once and not stop till you have accomplished my request in this letter. Write to me. Well-located reading rooms open to the public were a unique feature of the Christian Science movement, unique in the history of the world. Some branch churches in 1900 were maintaining rooms which could be models for the whole field to follow, while the Mother Church in Boston had none. The directors needed to see the importance of this issue. At the same time, the leader published a card in the Sentinel, which both encouraged and discouraged those who were undecided about attending the annual meeting. Card. Beloved students, in reply to the eager questions from the field, does Mrs. Eddy propose to attend the next annual meeting of the Mother Church? Will say, I shall not be with you personally, but do not let this prevent your attendance.